because I sort of think of writing parts as tailoring roles to an actor like a tailor would, you know, like a suit. I might start with thinking I want to make a wedding dress, but that's the kind of wedding dress is completely dependent on who's going to wear it.
Hello and welcome to In Writing with me, Hattie Crissell. And I'm sorry I've been gone for quite a long time, but it's very exciting to be back and thank you for joining me again. Today's guest is Lucy Prebble. She's an accomplished writer for both stage and screen. As a playwright, she won the George Devine Award for her first play, The Sugar Syndrome, in 2003 and followed that with the hugely successful Enron in 2009. Most recently, she wrote the thriller A Very Expensive Poison about the murder of Alexander Litvinenko, and that one won the Critics Circle Award for Best New Play in 2019. Lucy's television career is equally impressive. She was the creator of the series Secret Diary of a Call Girl in 2007, which started a long-running friendship and working relationship between Lucy and Billy Piper. They recently worked together again on I Hate Susie, which I really recommend if you didn't catch it. Lucy is also on the writing team for HBO's Succession. She spoke to me in January from her sister's house in the UK. Lucy is house hunting at the moment, so she's splitting her time between her sisters and New York, which is where Succession's third season is being very carefully filmed in the midst of the pandemic. An interesting fact, Lucy told me that the guy in charge of making the shoot COVID safe has previously worked managing disaster relief in Haiti. So that gives you some idea of how seriously they're taking it. She shared some insight into how Succession is written, and she was also very interesting about the relationship between writers and actors and why dialogue is not necessarily the most important element of a script or screenplay. Before we start, I'm very happy to say that today's episode is sponsored by Papier. Papier offers a unique collection of customizable stationery created in collaboration with artists, designers, and other stylish people, including Mother of Pearl, Laura Jackson, and Matilda Goad. Whether you're treating yourself to a new notebook to perk up your working from home setup, or whether you're looking for a wellness journal, Papier will have the design for you. Personally, I have most recently bought some personalised note cards from Papier, and I think that's a really good way to reach out to friends and family during the pandemic, so I'd recommend you look at their collection of personalised cards and writing paper. For a 15% discount on your first order, visit papier.com, that's P-A-P-I-E-R.com, and at checkout, use the code INWRITING, that's all one word, INWRITING. But now, back to today's interview, and here's Lucy Prebble.
For years, I had an office in my house, as in I had a room that was dedicated for writing. But about 3 years ago, I decided to rent a very, very small room about 15-20 minutes walk away from where I was living in Southeast London, and it was sort of a very, very small space with just a desk and a chair in a big old factory there, where people had basically bought it and were renting out some more spaces to anyone who needed any room for work. And I found it really, really useful. I'd spent years not doing that because I thought it was wasteful. You know, it seemed really odd to spend money that maybe at some points I didn't have, or on a space when I had, a home or a flat or wherever I was that I could write from. And it felt indulgent, is what it felt like, for a very long time. And then I just thought to myself one day, I really want to just try it. So maybe I try it for a few months. And so that was useful way of thinking about it, and it really changed a lot. It was so helpful, and I definitely probably did enough work to make the money back that I spent on renting it, which was only a few hundred pounds a month, but I definitely did more, and it was just an incredibly useful fight against procrastination, really, because you go to a different space that isn't particularly fun to be in, and there was a part, well, not unpleasant to be in, but where the whole thing is about writing. And you sort of know that when you finished your work for the day, you then get to go home, which you then get to associate with not working and positive things and relaxation and stuff. And that psychological divide was really helpful, and I kind of wished I'd done it years before.
And did you keep that office space quite sort of bare, or did you move stuff into it? I mean,
was pretty bare.
Yeah, to keep it sort of distraction free.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted it to be, you know, it was sort of pleasant, actually. It was, I kind of got it, I kind of painted it and got it looking nice, because what I didn't want was to enter into a space that felt depressing. That's really bad for writing, I think. I didn't want it to feel punishing. So it looked very nice. But what I didn't have was, you know, a television
yeah.
or a fridge or, you know, bookcase with loads and loads and loads of books. The only books in there would be things that I was working on, or that I, you know, research for things that I was working on. So it was quite deliberately bare. And I tried, I was quite annoyed, actually, because for ages I didn't have my Wi-Fi linked up to it, but I had my phone Wi-Fi attached to the Wi-Fi of the building. So I was like, okay, I just need to separate, you know, I think there's an old Dave Gorman joke where he says that it's so odd that the machine that you work on is also the machine that is attached to the entire world. And that basically it's pretty unlikely that you're not going to be more interested in the entire world than what you're working on. So I was like, okay, as long as I can divide the thing I type on from the entire world. And then, annoyingly, Apple developed that quite smart feature where as soon as you're connected on one device, it automatically can connect you on from other devices. So then my Wi-Fi got attached from my laptop.
Right. And so, right, let's go back a bit. So when do you remember first writing?
I used to write, my memories of the earliest things were, I wrote like sort of what you'd call now fan fiction. I had these books full of like sort of quite childish joined up handwriting of pretend episodes of things. But they weren't like written like a script. They were written like a story, you know. So there would be, there was like episodes of, I think, Cheers and the Golden Girls, but particularly Star Trek. There were a lot of, there's one quite disturbing one I found the other month where I basically like a sort of erotic short story of in the world of Star Trek The Next Generation that I'd clearly written. And, you know, it was sort of like, yeah, like a story, like so-and-so walks into here and sees that. And it's all very quite charming, but also sort of terrifying. And then the next thing I remember is, bad poetry, really, like shoebox under the bed kind of things about being unhappy or some unrequited feeling or something like that.
So talk me through sort of how writing then became your career.
I didn't know really what I wanted to do professionally. But I'd always written, and when I was at university I sort of fell in with friends who most of whom kind of wanted to be actors. I was doing an English degree at Sheffield, and some of the more dramary elements of that were people who I became very close friends with. And there was a festival at the time called the National Student Drama Festival. There still is, I think. And they really, really wanted to take a play to it, you know, like a sort of like student-y but much tiny Edinburgh festival. And they'd heard that the festival were not really accepting many classical plays, old plays anymore, like with students in, because they were kind of tired of seeing King Lear for the 10th time with a 19-year-old in it. And so they were very keen to go, well, can we do something modern? And I remember I said, oh, I write things. And they said, oh, well, why don't you write something? So I sort of wrote a very odd, not odd, kind of weak, almost sketchy, very sketchy play about graduates going to work at a sort of corporate consulting firm. It's funny, I was watching Industry, the TV show, the other day, and it reminded me a little bit of the idea of like, just what's it like when you first go somewhere like that after you've been at university. And it ended up getting in, and I didn't massively enjoy it going to the festival. In fact, I kind of didn't enjoy it at all. But I loved the bit where we were in rehearsals for the play with my friends and with the actors. I loved that bit. Anyway, so after I left university, that was one thing that happened that was sort of interesting and made me feel. It was maybe the first time that I had ever chosen to show my writing to anybody. I felt very defined by not wanting to show my writing to anybody. And in fact, the one time in my childhood where one of my siblings did find a diary and writing in it and showed it to my parents, I was profoundly distressed by it. And it was really a horrible experience that I felt emotionally sort of quite messed up by. And the fact that having written something for these friends and it had been quite a pleasurable experience to make sort of stayed with me. And then I left and I did the usual sort of trying to find a job things. I did a lot of temping, moved back to my mum and dad's. Did a lot of temping. I'd always done sort of temping throughout being a student and stuff. So I had a lot of a secretarial experience and reception experience from when I was about 15. I was always doing part-time work. And then I ended up, I applied for lots of things in the Guardian on Mondays used to have a kind of media section. And I think I knew that I wanted to do something in that area or be a lawyer. The other thing I wanted to be was a criminal barrister or a human rights barrister. So I applied for law school at the same time and got in. But when that happened, I kind of thought, oh, I'm not sure I actually want to do this without having tried this other route. So anyway, I ended up getting a secretarial position at the National Theatre. And I also applied at the same time for a Royal Court Young Writers Programme. There's a lot of applying for things. You know, when I look back, I'm quite amazed by the impetus that the younger me sort of showed, which I think I don't recognise quite so much anymore. But I guess that's what everyone was doing at the time. So I got on the Young Writers Programme at the Royal Court. I started working in the Director's Office at the National Theatre. And that's where I read an awful lot of scripts. Not because that was part of my job. In fact, it was very much not part of my job. And occasionally when a playwright would find out that I had read their script, I remember McDonough being very cross about that on one occasion because I wasn't really supposed to. I didn't work in the literary department. I did filing. And, but it was really useful because I was reading new plays, but I was reading plays that were before they were ready, which is really inspiring. And anyway, I was doing that. I was on the Young Writers Programme. I'd missed getting into my own age group. So I kind of kept calling them. And then eventually I think they got quite tired of me and put me in the younger group because there was enough space in the younger group. So I remember that was quite odd being a few years older than everybody. And one of the things I had to do was write a play. That was part of the course that Simon Stevens was teaching at the time. And the play that I was writing then eventually became the play The Sugar Syndrome, which was my first full-length play. And Graham Wybrow, the literary manager at the court, liked it enough to give it a short run at the court upstairs, which is a very small sort of 90-seater theatre. And then off the back of that, I got an agent. So that was sort of the beginning of my professional career. But it also might be interesting to say that, you know, some of the agents I met with didn't want to take me on. You know, it wasn't a sort of situation of having necessarily choice, although I did want to go with Rod and Charlotte. But I always felt very much like I was auditioning or interviewing.
Yeah. So that was 2003 that The Sugar Syndrome was first performed. Is that right?
I think so.
And I heard, I was listening to, I think it was the interview you did with Front Row on Radio 4 a few months ago, which is very good. I would encourage anyone to go and look that up. It's online. But you mentioned that when you revisited The Sugar Syndrome recently, you watched a production of it and you found it quite sort of wordy, too wordy and too much dialogue, or too maybe a bit overwritten, which I thought was really interesting. And then I was thinking about how in other forms of writing, such as novels, for example, everything that the writer puts on the page is delivered to the reader. You know, they see every word. Whereas for a playwright or a screenwriter, you're writing so much that is around the dialogue as well. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about that. I mean, how much of writing for theatre and TV is about what's actually being said, and how much is about what's not being said?
Yeah, I mean, I've been thinking recently about trying to write a novel or something, partly because of the world that we're in, and partly because I've done quite a lot of screen for the last few years, and there is something about the privacy and the complete control of prose that is compelling, you know, that's attractive. But yeah, theatre is different from screen in terms of the question you just asked. I think, like, how much is what's not written? I mean, I think there's a general confusion between the idea of dialogue and the idea of writing. So often what people mean when they say, you know, what's not written, is they mean what's not said by the characters. But dialogue is a very tiny part, really, of writing, for screen or for stage. Well, maybe less for stage. You know, there's that old cliche, there's that old thing of, like, in Shakespeare's time, you would say you were going to hear a play, not see a play, and there's a reason for that. But I suppose what I'm trying to say is that the work of writing is so much more about the story, the turns, what happens, and how the characters respond to it. And for me, the world is everything. That's where I start for most things. So you know, is it with Succession, that world is obviously a very rarefied corporate American family thing. With The Sugar Syndrome, the world is kind of the relationships that are forged online, maybe. So that's kind of where I would start. So your choice of world, your choice of characters, and then your choice of story, like literally what happens in what order, is so much more about what writing is than the dialogue, which is kind of icing, really. I think nice icing, but not the main bulk of the thing. And so, yeah, when I went to go and see The Sugar Syndrome, what I saw was a lot of like showing off in the writing, I suppose, might be one way of putting it, or the dialogue. There was a misunderstanding about that. So there was a lot of stuff that people said to each other that either people wouldn't necessarily really say to each other in real life, for the most part, or secondly, everyone knows what this is, where the writer is kind of trying to tell you something through what the character's saying. And that's, you know, really common, you know, thing, flaw, or and certainly a young writer's flaw, I think, because you're sort of wanting to go, look how clever I am. Or if you're being super kind to yourself, you're kind of trying to connect with people, but in a kind of clumsy way. And audiences pull back from that because they sense it immediately, and they kind of go, well, hang on, I'm not here for you to tell me things that you know. But of course, they are. The joke is that you just get better at hiding that. You just get better at manipulating them through other means. And what's clumsy about having characters sort of say things they know in order to show the audience what you think, you know, all that's really clumsy about that is how obvious you're being about it. Whereas if you actually make those feelings that you feel and those experiences that you've had be inherent in the movement of the story, the choices that people make quietly, and whether you think the story of a girl with an eating disorder meeting a paedophile is a tragedy or a comedy. You know, your choices in tone, your choices in genre will do a lot of that, and you won't actually hopefully have to point things out in dialogue in a slightly overwritten way. And that's what screens taught me more, because if you watch enough edits of your own work, when you can get really close to the face of an actor, you do realize how much more elegant it is to let them do some of the work. I think that's something else I had to really learn, is to stop trying to do other people's jobs for them, because that's partly what you're doing when you overwrite as well. You're not really trusting a director or an actor to understand something and an audience, so you're sort of putting it there in print, and the audience can sense that lack of trust, and obviously also so can actors. Having said all of that, I remember a great piece of advice from Jesse Armstrong about Succession, which he got from comedy, which is, if it isn't on the page, it won't get on the screen. And what he meant by that more was stage directions, was most people are going to only look at this once, you know, when they read it through, producers and directors, not directors necessarily, but Jesse were always saying, In theatre, you tend to actually not put certain stage directions in, because you're going to spend 6 weeks in a room with actors who are going, oh, maybe this is what I do at this point, maybe this is what I feel, and they discover something themselves, or they discover something better than what you imagined. But in TV and film, you just honestly don't have that time. So you put the stage, you put it down, you put down, like, you know, she can't believe that he said that, because you just don't want there to be ambiguity. Yeah. You have the time to rehearse, basically, which is kind of bonkers considering how much money is involved.
Yeah. Yeah. I discovered this morning, because I'm doing a creative writing MA at the moment, and I've just started a screenwriting module. And I discovered the BBC Writers Room website, that it has all of these scripts on there that you can just go and look at, which I didn't realise. And and so I sort of sat this morning and read the pilot episode of Motherland, you know, the sitcom. And I was really, blown away by how much of it is on the page. I don't think that screenwriters necessarily get the credit for how much of that other stuff has come from them. I mean, I know, obviously, yeah. The set designer does a lot, and wardrobe does a lot, and all of the other, you know, the cinematographer and all of that. But the fact that it's sort of in the vision from the beginning, I don't think writers necessarily get the full credit for that.
Well, of course, I would agree with you. But I mean... No, but I think that's right. And the first thing I've ever written, I think, where I really, really went full throttle in that direction was I Hate Susie, which is a show I just did for Sky. And the scripts of that are very, very detailed. And not just detailed, but much closer, actually, to writing a novel, by which I mean the descriptions of how people feel at each point are very direct and full. So it's almost like reading a first person short story, you know, like the stage directions of things like, you know, well, to be really basic about it, you know, after a line, you might have just the stage direction, oh shit. Or probably the most common stage direction is you know, in that show, which is, this is horrible,
yeah.
Which features a lot. But basically where the whole script is sort of really written from somebody's interior point of view. And I think that really made people respond to it much more when they read it. And I'd been kind of, before that, I'd sort of been much classier about writing screenplays. Like, I'd tried to be quite objective and neutral, because you're sort of taught, directors particularly don't want to be told how to shoot something, so you know, you don't put a camera move in or anything. Probably, but I had been a bit austere about it, even though I could see how it would look to me. I'd thought that the right thing to do was to keep the descriptions open and neutral. And actually, I think it's so much more effective to really, really, like, get in there with the world and with the tone and with the feeling of it moment to moment, so that you're not moving from writing a line of dialogue for a character to this sort of objective, fictional, godlike narrator who has no feeling about what's going on, which is what I was doing before.
That really comes across in I Hate Susie as well, because it's so visceral and intense to watch. I mean, it's fantastic. But
thank you.
Yeah, I think that, and maybe that's why, I guess.
Well, it's probably part of why. And the other script I think is always useful to read on that point that you make is to take a look at American Beauty. I think there's a lot of very incredibly well-regarded award-winning movies, which when you look at the screenplay, similarly to what you've just described, are, I mean, beat for beat on the page. And I think, yeah, it's funny when you ask people their favourite movies, almost none of them can name the writer, unless it's a writer who's also the auteur or star of it as well, which is surprising considering what a world they build. Yeah.
Let's get back to talking about your career. So Secret Diary of a Call Girl, that was your sort of first TV writing job, is that right?
No, I had TV writing jobs before. They never got made. I mean, that's the only reason I point it out is so that, you know, I think having a realistic vision of the industry is important. Like, it's not like you write something and then it sort of goes on immediately. I had two writing gigs that I did, i.e. like ideas with a production company that I wrote and got paid to write, but that never happened before that.
Right, okay. And so Secret Diary of a Call Girl was the first thing that kind of went ahead.
It got made, yeah.
Yeah. How did you make that move into television? Was it quite a sort of natural thing once you had an agent?
Yeah, I think it's more that at that time you had a lot of TV producers hanging around the Royal Court. And, you know, sometimes to the chagrin of the Royal Court, like, because I think theatre has understandably got an attitude of, well, hang on, we nurture, help and give opportunity to first time and second time writers over years, and then they kind of come in and get picked off by TV companies, and that is somewhat what was happening at the time. And as soon as they see that you can do dialogue, again, it's a kind of slight overvaluing of the skill of doing dialogue, TV producers would kind of approach you to work on things. And so I would have a lot of meetings, a lot of sort of general meetings, a lot of meetings of, do you want to come in and have a look at this book? We're looking for someone to adapt it. Would you like to put together a treatment and pitch for it? So you're just sort of brought into this very different world very quickly often, which maybe when I look back, I think was maybe a bit of a mistake. I think I'd have been better off staying in theatre a bit longer and learning my craft better before I jumped into doing TV. But the truth is, I couldn't afford to do that. The truth is, I needed to pay rent in London at the time. And so, you know, you'd get like £1,000 for potentially writing a 10-page treatment of something. And that was amazing to me. So for TV. So that's what I did. So it was... it was more that it was a different world. It felt very much like you were an employee going into an employer who was a production company or a channel and pitching them and sort of trying to get them to like what you were doing, or more commonly taking an idea that they gave you and then trying to make it work. But also very little got made. So it's an odd period when you start working in television, because everyone's sort of saying to you, oh my gosh, are you working in television? You know, what are you working on? And in my experience, I wasn't doing that route of soaps or The Bill or something where people have seen what you've done. I was kind of like writing scripts, delivering them, and then they weren't getting made. So it was very weird. It doesn't feel like a real job in a way. And then eventually with Secret Diary, I went to a production company and said, I've been reading this blog online, Belle de Jour, and I think there could be a really good TV show in it. And just by chance at that time, she was selling her book version of that blog, Belle was. And and they was and they bid for it and got it, and yeah, and that was the beginning of that, really, that I had by chance made myself attractive to them because I had sort of come to them with that very same idea.
And you did two series of Secret Diary and then you left. What were the big sort of learnings of that experience for you?
Well, it's funny to look back on it now. I can see much more. And also I'm kind of surprised that I did sort of leave it. Like it's hard to connect to that person completely. It attaches, I suppose, to what I was just saying. I was very much an employee of people who thought they had a good machine, you know, which was a show with a recognizable actress in it, you know, Billie Piper, about a kind of rather salacious and interesting world, but for a channel that was really interested in it being lightweight. I guess what I learned, I'm trying to think honestly, what I didn't like the show that I was making, and at some point I had to work out whether or not I was going to change the show so that I liked it, or not work on the show that I didn't like. There wasn't really a third option for me, and that's not because I don't know why that is, but it would not have occurred to me for that. To do something else other than one of those two things. At the time, to be really honest, I don't think I learned anything. Like at the time, I just felt I'd failed people, let people down, and was kind of cowardly, refuse sort of not going on with something. And so at the time, I felt very negative about it and bad about it. Now, when I look back, what I feel I learned or I taught myself was that I wouldn't be happy in a situation where I was very much a kind of employee, trying to meet a vision that I didn't really believe in. And also, maybe on a more controlling level, that I don't think I wanted to be the sort of writer who kind of wrote scripts, delivered them, then disappeared off and didn't really care what happened after that. So in retrospect, I guess what I taught myself is that that was not a particularly happy set up for me, and now I wouldn't be in one quite like that. Also, I was very, very young, and I think that was so it was fair enough. I think in some ways what they were trying to do was support me being in my I think I was my early mid-20s, and I think what they were trying to do was give me as much support as possible, as in as in sort of have me as a kind of writer employee and then have everyone else make decisions and be in charge of the show. And now I realize that I need to be in charge of the
Yeah.
show, controlling as that sounds.
Let's move on to Succession. Could you talk me through just briefly how the sort of writer's room works?
Yeah, sure. So, for a few months every year, I think it's normally 3 months, maybe slightly less. A group of writers get together in a room well, it moves around, but normally in South London. And there's between 6 and 10 of us most of the time. And the writers have changed a bit, but there's a core group, and try and come up with the next season of Succession. And normally Jesse will have a basic idea of something. We'll sort of go, I think the end point is this season, and I'm interested in that. But that varies. Sometimes he's really, really open to changing that. And then you start from scratch and you sort of like put stuff up on the walls, talk through. Normally we only do 4 to 5 hours a day. It's hard to We do sometimes do it if we need to, but it's hard to concentrate sort of 6 to 8 hours in the way that produces good work. And you just try and make each other laugh. You try and move each other. You sometimes tell personal stories. You often just pitch episodes or episode events at each other. And then by the end of that period, there's stuff all over the wall.
Okay, so you're starting from a, let's say that Jesse comes in and he has a very kind of vague arc in mind for the season. And then do you start by putting in place kind of some what the different sort of major events of the season might be? And then are you filling it in from there and then gradually moving further towards looking at dialogue and stuff? Or how it's probably a really stupid question, but for somebody who's never been into a writing room.
We would, I think, if my memory, we normally start with where did we leave the characters last time? Much more likely to start from character, I think. So what that means is it's the difference between what you put up on the wall. If you imagine we use those big pieces of white paper that sort of stick to the wall, and the title of each of those pieces of paper is more likely to be Connor, Kendall,
Right.
Roman than it is episode one, episode. In fact, we definitely wouldn't do that. We definitely wouldn't start like that with episodes or with events, I think. So you put up, and then you kind of think, here are things I would love. Like at the beginning, you start from a really, really, really broad, vague standpoint. I think it's almost like small talk at the start of a party, like you're kind of, which is the way that Jesse often refers to running a writer's room, which is think of it as you're hosting a party. So the first few weeks even might be conversations about, wouldn't it be great if Connor did this, or wouldn't it be, interesting to watch Kendall go through that? And so that's how you'd start and put anything up that really resonated. Sometimes we might talk about stuff that's happened in the real world, not because we base stuff on the real world, but because of what it kind of the jumping off point of that sometimes is, that you kind of then move on to, you talk about, oh my God, did you see this in the news about so and so? And we'll also read a lot. So normally one person will be given a little bit of a book to read, anything from the biography of someone in corporate America through to like a record of the collapse of a particular company or whatever it is that the season might have, and that person can sort of report back on what's interesting about that book. And then gradually over time, those things that are up on the wall become like one mega wall, and that wall will start to like it'll be a huge graph with the episodes down the left-hand side, one to whatever, and then the character names across the top, reading left to right, and then that huge, and that'll take up like a really, really massive long 20-foot wall, and then the whole season eventually will be sort of written up on that with just plot points or event points. And we will eventually get to a point, less events, interestingly. And I think maybe this is because of co the comedy background of a lot of the writers involved. There'll often be a sense of situation. So there'll often be like someone will pitch, wouldn't it be great if there was an episode where, they all went on a hunting trip, and that happened in season two. And so I wouldn't call that an event so much as a situation, and I think that comes from comedy, that idea of the sitcom, and that's where you sort of start with character and situation.
Yeah, and some of the best episodes of Succession, I think, have been those almost location episodes where they've gone off to, was it Argestes or,
Yeah, Argestes, yeah, episode 6 of season 2, yeah.
that awful weekend away that they did where they did boar on the floor.
Yeah, that's the hunting one, yeah, in
Yeah,
Hungary, yeah.
I have to say, I'm so excited for the third season of Succession. I was thinking this morning that basically the big things I'm looking forward to at the moment are my parents getting vaccinated and then season three of Succession.
You've got them in the right order. That's, yeah.
So what then tips you from being part of the general melee of the writer's room for the season into getting a particular writing credit on a particular episode?
This is a tricky one. I mean, so the guild, American shows tend to operate obviously under the American Writers Guild rules. So what that means is when we've got everything up on the wall, at some point, Jesse will distribute episodes to different writers. Sometimes it's clear because sometimes it'll be like, oh, Will has always been the one that's really, really, really done the research and kind of committed to, this episode. So he gets that one. And sometimes it'll just be more randomly distributed. And those people do the first draft that then goes to Jesse and then goes to some other writers. And I think the thing about American television that's quite difficult for some people to, and American film actually as well, is sometimes the thing that you watch is, in movies particularly, is sort of very little remains of the credited writer from it because it's had a lot of work done on it. If, for example, like if you look at The Simpsons, if you watch an episode of The Simpsons, there's always like so many producers listed, and they're not producers, they're all writers, on the app. That's just what it's referred to as. And you and that's normal. The guild rules quite rightly are that the person who is given the job to write the episode is credited as writer on it, and that's quite right. And we're a very democratic kind of situation with Jesse very much in the lead, who does the final rewrite on everything. So yeah, so in short, the sort of first few meaningful drafts will go between the writer it was originally given to Jesse, and then to some other writers on the show to do passes, and then the final, draft and polish will be Jesse's. But all in all, it's quite democratic. But it's interesting because I, that's again something that just most people wouldn't really know. So occasionally, when you watch a movie, because the agency and the guild rules are so strict, sometimes the special thanks at the end will actually be for somebody who did the major rewrite, but you
It's
would never
really
know that.
confusing. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was going to ask, sort of, I know that you said you haven't worked in a lot of writers' rooms, but I'm not specifically referring to Succession here, but I wondered whether part of the success of that as a system is that there's a competitive element in the sense that if you're in a room full of other people who are at a similar point in you as you in their sort of writing careers or whatever it is, you want to impress people. So I wondered whether that is part of why it gets good work out of everyone, that, if there's any air of competition, or is that too harsh a view of it? Is it much warmer than that?
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, I would say for me, it's completely the opposite. And by completely the opposite, what I mean is the writer's room is probably, I've only worked in Succession, so this is, I mean, I can only talk about that. The writer's room is probably the place I feel safest in the world, like in terms of it, particularly if you want people to be funny. I think people are funny when they feel safe, or at least I am. I know there's a sort of cliche and definitely a truth in one-upmanship and competitiveness and the sort of the American writer's room cliche of everyone trying to like top each other. And maybe that does produce really good funny work. Maybe it does, of a different kind. But I would say that most times when you make a joke, I'd say like 40% of the time it's bad, 40% of the time it's okay or good, and 20% of the time it's absolutely killer. And you have to, and that's sort of consistent. So you have to be in a space where you feel you can make the 40% of bad jokes in order for somebody to have the courage or comfort to make the 20% that are going to absolutely floor you. And so you have to create that environment. And part of that is being kind and vulnerable. And when you're going in and seeing the same people every day for months and months and sitting in a room with them for hours talking about sometimes quite personal stuff, sometimes when you're coming up with ideas for characters, you're automatically going, well, listen, when I broke up with so and so, or when my mother was ill, or whatever it is, because otherwise you've got nothing to draw from. So you have to have that space. You get to know each other really well. And it's a little bit like school, but without having to do, without sort of feeling you're being controlled by people who tell you where you have to be all the time. It feels very, you forge very, very close friendships. And I think as somebody, as a writer who has spent most of my career on my own with a laptop screen, I found it such a gift to have somewhere to go at a certain time, to be around people who were nice and made me laugh. It was just like a dream. Yeah. So I would almost say for me, it's the opposite of being competitive. It's actually a place where you're being paid to be vulnerable, and the best work always comes from that.
That's much nicer than my vision of it. So I'm glad to hear that. we touched on this a bit earlier, but you're working with incredible actors. I mean, Billy Piper in I Hate Susie, I couldn't believe how good she was. And in Succession, you have this huge cast of really, you know, actors who are all absolutely at the top of their game. How does the role of the actor play into what you do as a writer?
For me, it's a lot. Those are different. Those are slightly different projects in the sense that I wrote I Hate Susie specifically for Billy, and we created it and came up with the idea of it together. So from the very start, the whole idea of the show and every moment of the show was inspired by what I knew that she could do well, because I sort of think of writing parts as tailoring roles to an actor like a tailor would, you know, like a suit. I might start with thinking I want to make a wedding dress, but that's the kind of wedding dress is completely dependent on who's going to wear it. So with Billy, that's at its most extreme, which is I know how talented she is as an actor. She's been a very close friend of mine for years and years and years. I've seen everything she's done. And then I think, okay, so what does she do better than anybody else in the world, and how can we make a show out of that? But the other extreme, something like Succession, you're evolving more. So you're watching what they do all the time on set and in takes, and then of course in final episodes. And then the next time you go back into the writer's room, I mean, I'm often somebody who will say, oh God, yes, this is the road we should be going down with, whoever, with Matthew or with Kieran or with Brian, because, you know, don't forget how brilliant they were at that moment there. I think we can push further in that direction and give them more of that. Because you want everyone to look really, really good. So you want to kind of, and sometimes you get a sense that an actor is brilliant at one or two things, and so you want to keep returning to different versions of those one or two things. And sometimes you get a sense that an actor can kind of do anything, and then you go, well, what do I want to see this character do if I could see them do anything? What's the least expected thing and stuff like that? So I'm hugely inspired by actors all the time. Sometimes it comes down to quite like basic practical stuff. Like sometimes we can get a bit airy fairy talking about the art of things. But so for example, this is more on other projects I do, but in theatre, there are some actors who can speak really, really quickly and be really clear and be really like hyper articulate. And you do give them more complicated lines because you know that they'll be able to pull them off and it won't feel written, you know. And there are some actors who do not do that, who's natural, you know. Actors have a natural rhythm sometimes. Often they have a natural weight. That's the thing that I think it's difficult for an actor to change, their weight. Some actors are kind of a violin, some actors are a cello. Like, so they can't really change their weight. And so if you have somebody whose sense of weight is very, very sort of low and heavy and strong, and they speak with authority, but they speak slowly, you'll have to rewrite the lines where you're sort of wanting them to be incredibly quick and articulate and witty and sort of change and have three emotions during the same speech. Like, that's not how their rhythm would be. They're a bass note, and you kind of have to learn how to play them. And then eventually you get to a point where you're hiring actors who you know already specifically because you want them to do a certain part. But you have to, you know, that takes a little bit while in the industry maybe to get to know that number of actors where you're thinking, oh, that we need that person there or that person there. So yeah, you change. Yeah, and I rewrite around actors all the time. You know, I'm not the kind of writer who expects them to do every. Well, let me rephrase. I expect them to do the lines that are on the page, as it were. I don't really like too much improvisation unless we've said let's do a free take, which I do all the time. But what I do is I rewrite the lines once I've heard them do them. That's what I do, and then I'm kind of rewriting according to what I could feel naturally they wanted to do.
Yeah. Do you plan to return to theatre, or do you feel like you're more sort of embedded in TV now?
At the moment, there isn't any theatre, is there? So it's kind of a bit depressing. Yeah, I want to. I do eventually. If I have the right ideas, I have two ideas at the moment: one big, one small. That eventually, hopefully, I'll do in theatre if everything, you know, does come back. I love it. I love the sense of family of it. You know, when you do theatre, you are sitting in a room with the same people. It's a bit like the writer's room, I suppose. You're sitting in the same room with a bunch of people every day for a period of time, talking about stuff, getting to know each other. It's a bit like people coming and sitting around a campfire and the play is the fire. And whereas TV and film, as wonderful as they are, they're very shattered as experiences. You're rarely in the room with everybody ever, apart from maybe a reading of an episode. And even then, there's always loads of people who can't make it and can't come and have to watch a recording of it or whatever. And from that point on, every scene you do, every shot you make is just a bunch of people running from one location to another, trying to capture this moment and then running back into the van and going somewhere else where there's a different group of actors waiting for you to do the next shot. Like it's like ants. It's like an anthill kind of, everyone's always doing stuff. It's not, there's no center to it. There's just a lot of movement everywhere. And so that's good if you want to feel that sense of aliveness and temporariness, which has its virtues. But if you want a sense of solidity and family, theatre's where you want to be, really. Not if you want any money, though.
I ask everyone this. Can you think of, you know, looking back, is there a moment that stands out where you learnt something about writing that really improved your work?
I started saying no to things. I think it took me a very long time to change from being reactive to other people's propositions and ideas, and then being quite unhappy, to going, well, what if I say no to things, even though that feels frightening and risky, and then I write something or come up with something myself and try and sell it. So the point where I tried to alter the power dynamic of being basically an employee of large companies who want you to write something for them, which is, you know, great and all well and good and appropriate sometimes, into reconsidering myself as an author of things that I go to people and try and sell to them, was really big for me. And that's something we did with Susie. Like Billy and I decided what we were going to do is come up with a show, and I was going to write the first or even the first two episodes and then take it to people, which was completely different from how you normally do business, which is they'll come to you, then they'll have a vision of something, then they'll look at your drafts and they'll note you so that you do drafts that are more like what it is they originally employed you to do. It's just a totally different job in a way, and it is much more risky and less secure, but it's so much better for my personality type and also for, I think, doing good work, because I was so reactive before. I was so people-pleasy. I was so like, oh, okay, you want it to be like this, do you? And then I was miserable because I was writing something I didn't like and also that was not very good in the end, I think. Because when you're writing something you're not really into, it's hard to access the bits of you that are good. So I started to make that decision, which was perverse because I am... You know, I'm scared of running out of work. I'm scared of running out of money. But I made a perverse choice, which was to say no to things in order to say yes to things that I wanted to do. And by far the best work or the most successful things I've ever done were in that area, even though it was a risk. So that was one thing. fairly recently, John Mulaney, the stand-up, talks about a moment where he really changed his stand-up style, which was very wordy, because somebody said to him after the gig, you know, these people, they have no time for your cleverness. And it's a line that always stuck with me, because it was a reminder that one of the things I was always trying to do with my writing was to inform and entertain people and share the excitement about things I'd discovered that I thought were interesting and clever. And I really made me think, yeah, like, what now when I write, I think really hard about what would this be if it wasn't clever? Because it's just like a thing I've had throughout my career, is so much of my work has always been referred to with that word. And it's actually not a very praising word. It's quite a pejorative word, clever. Like, it sort of means, it's either like clever, where you're kind of being dismissive of somebody being tricksy, or clever clogs, which is like someone showing off. Or it's like an insult to a comedian. If you say your jokes are clever, it's really fucking insulting. It means they're not funny. So it's not a word that we use actually much in praise. And I think I was always very aware of that it was attached to my work. And I feel like there's more to me than that, or at least I wanted there to be. And so I started to kind of try and avoid that a little bit.
And what are you proudest of when you look back on your writing life so far?
I find pride quite a difficult emotion. I know what you mean. So I know what I feel I'm supposed to say. What do I feel proudest of? I guess linked to what I last said, I feel pleased that I have written a couple of things. I think A Very Expensive Poison, the last play I wrote, and also I Hate Susie, were much more emotional pieces of work than some of the stuff I'd done before. And by that I mean I felt had the capacity to move people, to make people feel things, and were sort of about my feelings in a way that maybe I'd hidden a bit more before. And I feel pleased about that. I feel a sense of relief about that, actually, more than pride. Pride is quite a difficult emotion for me to access. It feels... I know what you mean, and I know what that looks like, but I don't know if I say to you, I'm really proud of that. Oh, yeah, no, I have a few moments. There were a few moments in Susie when we were doing edits of episodes and I would be sent the edit, and when it wasn't working. Episode 4 was particularly difficult. It's the episode where Susie masturbates for pretty much the whole episode, and it all takes place within her head. And it was so difficult, that episode, to make sense. And I remember I did a few edit passes on it where I knew that before I'd done the pass, it had been almost incomprehensible. And after I'd done it, it was good. And I did feel a sense, I felt, you know how to, you have got to a point in your writing career where you understand innately how to make a story work. And that's a lifetime's job, that. I mean, I wouldn't say I know everything about that, but I have a skill now. I have a craft that 10, 20 years ago, I just definitely didn't have. I was throwing stuff at a wall. So I feel a little bit like a plumber who knows that if they go to a certain job, they can at least definitely, you know, install a radiator. Like, you know, you could do it. And you might come up against all sorts of problems. And there might be a time where the radiator is, you know, not one you've ever seen before or whatever. But I know that I can install a radiator. And when you start out, I don't think you do know that. Like, you don't. You're kind of like wandering around writing stuff, giving it to people, going, this, what do you think? Maybe. And then other people sort of helping you get it to a point where it fundamentally works.
Feels good to know that you can install that radiator now.
Install that narrative radiator. Yeah, it does.
A huge thank you to Lucy Prebble for that interview, which I found really fascinating, and I hope you all enjoyed it as much as I did. A bit of news for this series, I have become an affiliate of bookshop.org, which is an online bookshop with a mission to financially support local independent bookshops. How many times can you say bookshop in one sentence, Hattie? What that means in practice is that I now have a sort of shop front on bookshop.org where you can find books that have been mentioned on the podcast or books by writers that I have interviewed. If you buy one of those books, 10% commission comes to me and helps me to continue making the podcast. So it's a really nice way to support. But more importantly, 10% goes into a pool which is distributed between independent booksellers. So it's a really nice way to support small businesses, particularly at this time during the pandemic. You can find my shop at uk.bookshop.org/shop/in-writing, and I'll put that URL in the show notes as well. But if it's simpler, you can just go to bookshop.org and search for my name, and it should come up under shops. This week, I'm recommending that you buy a new collection of Lucy Prebble's plays. It includes The Sugar Syndrome, Enron, The Effect, and A Very Expensive Poison. So you'll find that on my page. I will be back next week with another writer. And in the meantime, if you enjoyed the podcast, I would love it if you would give it a rating and a review. And also, please come and say hello to me on Twitter or Instagram, because it's always nice to chat to listeners. Bye for now.